What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This is Barron's Live. Each week, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our weekly webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today for a look at the markets and a conversation with David Donabedian, Chief Investment Officer at CIBC Private Wealth Management. Barron's senior writer Nicholas Jasinski is also on the line today. Nick follows the Fed and the markets, and like all of us here at Barron's, he wears a lot of hats. The market was up this morning, the Fed is meeting this week, and we have a lot to cover on this call. So welcome, Dave and Nick. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Lauren. Hi, Dave.
Great to be here.
Wonderful. Let's get started, Dave. I thought I would start with a status report and basically ask you, where are we in this market cycle, Dave? Just when we think the exuberance of the past few months is finally fading, we seem to get another sharp rally. So it's hard to tell what the market wants to do right now. How do things look to you?
Yeah, well, I think the headline would be that this is a global bull market.
We could stop there.
That's right.
But let's not.
Keep it on a high note, right? But I mean, if you just look at it objectively, the S&P 500 is up almost 25% since October. We've seen repeated all-time highs in most of the major indices here, and that's broadened out. We've seen new all-time highs in a number of European markets, in Japan, and some other overseas markets. So, global bull market. And
so how do we know it's going to continue? Or do we know that?
Well, we never know that. I think that we're in a bull market, which means that it's durable and it is going to go on for some time. I think the question investors need to figure out is, when will there be an obstacle or a slowdown? We always have pullbacks and corrections, even in healthy bull markets. And, it wouldn't be at all surprising sometime in 2024 to see the market correct. I think one of the things that has driven this strong market environment over the last 4 or 5 months has been a very rosy macro scenario in terms of what consensus expectations are, right? The expectations, inflation keeps coming down, the economy, we're not worried about recession anymore. There's almost a bulletproof view of the economy that it's just going to keep chugging along, which in turn would produce double-digit earnings growth, all the while allowing the Fed to cut rates as the year goes on. That's a pretty rosy scenario. At some point, it's going to be challenged.
I was going to ask, does the consensus bother you?
Yeah, I think it's a little too rosy. I think that particularly on, I'm sure we'll talk more about inflation with the Fed meeting coming up, but the other thing we have our eye on is economic growth, which, as I said, people have just penciled that in. The recession fears from last year are gone, and now it's average to above average growth almost no matter what. I actually think that may be a bit of a problem. In other words, we're going to start to see some signs of the economy slowing. You don't see it in the data yet, but I don't believe we've yet seen sort of the maximum anti-growth impact of those 11 rate hikes that the Fed engineered, and I think we will as the year goes on. So that of course might lead to some concerns about whether or not we achieve the 10 or 11% earnings growth that are expected. At some point, given where valuations are, earnings are going to need to kind of catch up here, and that could be the cause of a pullback or correction sometime this year. But again, in the context of a trend that's a bull market.
So let's
it certainly feels like a bull market still in place. It also feels to me, though, that a stronger economy and stronger earnings, lower inflation and looser Fed policy, and you can have two of those three at most at one time. And it feels like some of the bulls out there are expecting all of that all at once, which gives a little reason for pause when everybody seems so bullish all at once.
Do you agree with that, Dave?
I do. And, you know, if you kind of look at market internals, that rosy scenario has not only led to nice gains in the stock market, but it's also led to an environment of very low volatility in the bond market as well, actually. And at some point, that environment, kind of to Nick's point, kind of looks more like complacency than anything else. And we do see a lot of equity market sentiment indicators kind of, you know, borderline frothy. So again, it suggests, you know, perhaps some near-term caution.
So let's drill down a little bit and look at this week's FOMC meeting. That's the Federal Open Market Committee. It's the Fed's policy arm. We've got the meeting. We've got the release of the so-called dot plot of Fed officials' interest rate expectations. We have a press conference starring Fed Chair Jay Powell, and we have a whole lot more. So what do you expect to hear from the Fed this week, Dave? And how does that relate to your longer-term economic outlook?
Sometimes the Fed meetings, when you kind of know they're not actually going to do anything, are the trickiest ones. And so while it's widely expected that you're not going to see any, you know, change in rates, it then goes to, well, what is the context? What is the language around the Fed's thinking? And then this time, of course, we have the dot plots, the statement of economic projection. So, you know, a couple of things I'll be looking for on language. You know, does Powell indicate any concern about a lack of progress on inflation, right? The January and February inflation data were at least mildly disappointing. Does he respond to that in a way in which he says, well, that's just monthly noise in the data. We're very confident that inflation is going to move toward our 2% target, or does he acknowledge that it's somewhat concerning? That would be one big deal. And then the other in the actual dot plots, is there a possibility that you get a downgrade in the number of expected rate cuts over the course of the year, say from 3 to 2? It wouldn't take that many changed minds on the FOMC for that to happen. And actually, if you look at the futures markets today, it's almost down to a 50-50 proposition on when we get that first rate cut in June. So those are the things I'll be looking for.
What is your take on inflation? Are you concerned that the Fed is going to have a much harder time getting to 2%?
I actually don't. I think it's, you know, it's been said many times that, you know, the move from 9 to 3 on the inflation rate may be harder than getting from 3 to 2. There's some grain of truth to that, but I do think as the months roll on here, inflation is going to move closer to the Fed's 2% target. The inflation measure the Fed follows is actually already down to 2.8. And because I do think we're going to have a patch of economic weakness, I think that furthers the case of weaker inflation. So I in the end, expect we'll get those 3 rate cuts, actually maybe more, but they may well end up being more kind of back end loaded to the second half.
Mm-hmm. When, of course, the Fed ends up butting up against the presidential election, which may cause some problems.
Yeah, that's always a matter of debate, right? How political is the Fed? Do they adjust the timing of their decisions?
Or how political do they appear without necessarily being political?
That's fair, right? Optics, agreed. Right. They if the circumstances allow, all else being equal, they would love to be as off the radar screen as possible for the, you know, couple of months leading up to the election. I also think, though, that the lack of action, depending on the circumstances, can also be deemed as political. So I believe if there is an impetus based on what they're seeing in inflation and growth data to do something, do it.
So, Nick, I want to turn to you. You're going to be heading to Washington this week to attend the Powell press conference. What is on your mind on the eve of your trip and the FOMC meeting?
Yes, I will. I will be there. So I think, as Dave mentioned, no change in interest rate expected. And what really will be the focus for me is going to be that summary of economic projections and what Powell says at the press conference. Like Dave mentioned, since the start of the year, the inflation data, the economic data has generally been stronger than expected. The last dot plot was in December of 2023, so all that data has come in since then. Fed officials are adamant all the time that the dot plot is not a plan, it's not It's not a strategy that's come up as a FOMC body, but it really is a collection of individual predictions. Nonetheless, it is instructive to provide some insight to what officials are thinking about and does have some influence on the narrative. Since the start of this year, at the beginning of 2024, futures markets were pricing in, I think, 6 quarter point rate cuts by the end of the year. That's now down to 3 beginning in June. Now it's 50-50, sort of a coin flip on the timing of when that starts. And that's come along to those 3 cuts, which were in the December dot plot. It'll be very interesting to see how that median dot moves, whether that changes to 2 or stays at 3. And also in that summary of economic projections, there's an economic growth number. There's a core PCE inflation prediction. That was predicting 2.4% for 2024 on the median dot in the December dot plot. We went above that so far this year. It'll be very interesting to see how Fed officials' assumptions have changed. One other thing that may come out of the press conference will be a discussion of tapering, of quantitative tightening. It seemed from the minutes from the January meeting that officials were thinking about tapering QT. And so there may be more of that discussion at the meeting this week. It's not like there'll be specific plans, but we may get a little more insight into what that process will look like. In general, I think it's hard to imagine Powell being more dovish in his remarks than he was in January or at his congressional testimony a couple of weeks ago, given the data that's come out since then. I expect him to take a bit of a hawkish tone.
So I want to turn now to central bank action elsewhere in the world, namely Japan. The Bank of Japan will render an interest rate decision on Tuesday, and it looks finally set to end zero interest rate policy that's prevailed since 2007. That is almost 20 years ago. People are expecting a rate hike. What do you see for Japan, Dave? What are you expecting there?
I think that scenario makes a lot of sense. Japan has emerged out of, you know, a decades long period of not just disinflation, but deflation. The outlook looks more, I guess I would say, more normal in terms of the mix of growth and inflation. And so I think, that policy shift by the BOJ makes a good deal of sense and actually will be well received by the markets. And you know, the Japanese equity market has become a very interesting place, and you might argue it's the first time you can say that in almost 30 years. But due to some a fair amount of corporate restructuring and reform, as well as a better macro backdrop, it's actually a really interesting equity market.
You know, it just shows you how long abnormal situations can last.
Right.
When you talk about that. Nick, any thoughts on Japan from you?
I think that's the key point there, that it's not moving from negative interest rates to zero or very low isn't really, it's not necessarily that the Bank of Japan is tightening policy. It's more just getting back to normal. And that's a response to the economy doing well. Last week there was statistics on wage inflation in Japan, and it was around 5% year over year, which is the fastest it's been seen in decades. At the same time, the Japanese economy is doing okay. It's narrowly avoided the technical definition of a recession in the second half of last year. It was one quarter of negative GDP growth. The quarter after that was about flat. So it's not an economy that warrants some sort of aggressive hiking, tightening cycle, but it doesn't necessarily warrant negative interest rates either. And that's going to be just one meeting. It's somewhat unclear what happens after that first hike. They could pause. They could hike again, basically taking it one meeting at a time. And really, it's the opposite problem of what we have in the U.S., where they're trying to keep inflation up at 2%, as opposed to trying to get it down to 2%. So it's more about normalizing policy. It's not tightening, and I think that is a good sign for, as Dave said, for investors in Japan, that the things are getting back to normal, and it's asset prices are not so sensitive to this extremely stimulative monetary policy, but it's actual corporate earnings and economic growth that will drive assets in Japan. So I think that's a good thing.
That makes sense. I wonder if negative interest rates are ever truly warranted, but that's a debate for economic history. So I want to move want to move on to some earnings highlights this week, Nick. Let's talk about a couple of companies that are reporting at the tail end of the quarter. We are going to hear from Micron on Wednesday. What's the outlook there?
Micron Technology, it's a memory chip maker, one of the big three in that industry, alongside Samsung and SK Hynix, both in South Korea. And this is the most cyclical corner of the semiconductor industry. It's supply is relatively fixed. You have these huge factories that cost billions and billions of dollars and can't be built overnight. And in the short term, demand swings pretty widely. So you get these boom and bust cycles tied to pricing and volumes and inventory at customers. And right now, this industry is in an upswing. You see that in Micron's results. The stock has doubled over the past 15 months. There's definitely a lot of good news priced into it. The results are for the, it's sort of a funny fiscal quarter, December, January, February, those 3 months. But anyway, year over year earnings are, revenues are expected to be up 44%. Earnings per share are a loss of 26 cents, but that's better than a loss of $1.91 per share in the same quarter a year ago. The question for these kind of businesses really is, what is the right part of the cycle to buy them? And the answer is, hindsight is 2020, and you want to buy them right before the cycle begins to turn, but before everybody else has come around to that view. That's why the stock has doubled over the past 15 months, even as we're in the very early innings of this upcycle or upturn in the memory cycle. Like I said, there's a lot of good news priced into it. It trades for 14 times next year's earnings estimate, which is about its average PE multiple over the past 10 years. On book value, it's above its average. The optimistic view is that AI upgrades over the coming years are going to lead to this super cycle for memory, because the chips require more memory to run, and that'll drive demand. Plus, these are the cutting edge chips, which are they have higher profit margins. And this is what Micron refers to in their reports as high bandwidth memory. So I think there'll be a lot of focus on that line item. But it's like I said, there's a lot of good news priced into it. And the earnings growth looks great. It's just, you'd expect the multiple to compress as the cycle goes ahead and to widen at the bottom. So the time to buy this may have been a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Well said, I think. All right, let's talk about Nike. The company reports on Thursday. It's been a tough business lately for the sneaker maker. There's a lot of competition. There are questions about consumer spending. What's the outlook for Nike?
Yeah, everybody's wearing Hokas and On sneakers, and that's more of a North America and Europe phenomenon. They are really global. The other thing they've had to deal with over the past few years has been supply chain challenges with most of their production in Asia and sales all over the world. So the overall consensus is revenue down 1% year over year, earnings per share down 5%. A little different region by region. North America is still the biggest for Nike, and I think that'll be the focus. We've been reading news reports that there's excess inventory at wholesalers and retailers. So earnings or revenue there is supposed to fall 6% according to the analyst consensus. China, on the other hand, is going to be, the year-over-year comparison is going to be to the end of the zero COVID policies. So the numbers should look much better there. Overall, however, the long-term story for Nike has been, it's this global leader in sports and casual apparel and footwear. It's moving to an increasingly digital direct-to-consumer model that's going to be good for profit margins. The past few years have thrown a wrench into that narrative. Shares are down 40% from their high in 2021. It's at more 24 than a times wrench. Earnings.
It's like a whole tool.
Yeah, toolbox. More than a wrench. So it's still a somewhat pricey stock. I think investors want to see it return to that algorithm that it had before of growing revenue and earnings faster than revenues because of expanding profit margins. So that's the challenge for management now to show that.
So last one is FedEx. They report on Thursday. The stock is about flat this year. It's up about 17% over the past 12 months. And FedEx is often seen as a barometer for the economy. What's the outlook for earnings?
Yeah, it's another somewhat cyclical, economically sensitive one. The comparison is always FedEx versus UPS, and FedEx has had some operational unforced errors that are really specific to them over the past few years. A good economy should be good for FedEx, but they just can't seem to get out of their own way. They're in this multi-year restructuring, which they've missed some targets there. Compared to UPS, UPS is growing faster and it's more profitable with wider profit margins. for the quarter, again, this is December, January, February, the consensus is revenue down 1%, earnings per share up 2%. January was a bad weather month in a lot of the US, so I would expect if they miss, management was going to point to that. If they do better, then no one's going to mention weather. It's one of those things that weather always is a handy excuse when things go badly. But the focus for the longer term investors will be on margins, how those are comparing to UPS, anything management says about the time frame or progress on this company-wide transformation they're embarking in, which is supposed to make it more efficient and reduce costs. But the stock is at 12 times earnings now. That's certainly undemanding. UPS is more like 18 times. So it's if you're confident in management that they're going to do the transformation and it goes well, this should be a winning stock. It's a, you got a combination of a good economic backdrop, these really individual company specific opportunities to improve margins, discounted valuation. Something they need some good news though. The stock, it's up 17% over the past year, like you mentioned, but it's really, it's where it was in beginning of 2020, right before COVID.
You need no more unforced.
It hasn't gone where. Exactly.
All right. Sounds good. Let's get Dave back into the conversation. Dave, I want to ask you a bit about your investment process. How do you go about picking sectors and deciding where to allocate money in the market? You've got an awful lot of choices, of course, as any investor does, but what's your process?
Well, I think, you know, the investment industry always seems to divide itself between, you know, value stocks and growth stocks, value stock picking versus growth. But when you think about it, everybody really wants some of both, right? We want to own companies with attractive growth prospects, but you know, you want to do it at some kind of a valuation discount. That's all easier said than done. And, you know, one tool that we use very heavily as a way to sort of wade through all that is free cash flow analysis. So, you know, cash generation and then assessing whether management does the right things with that cash to accrue shareholder value or something we pay an awful lot of attention to. And obviously a company that can consistently raise and grow significant amounts of free cash flow, that's certainly a marker of a quality company. But then also, as I said, looking at how does management make the right decisions on how to deploy that free cash flow to further enhance shareholder value. And the interesting thing about this approach is it leaves you with a portfolio of companies, some of which might conventionally be considered value stocks and some of which might conventionally be viewed as growth stocks. So that's a key part of our analysis when we're kind of pulling companies apart.
So where has it led you today in the world of tech? I know that you are overweight technology, but not necessarily the Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, I mean, if you just to start there, if you kind of look at the Magnificent Seven, which I guess some people have downgraded to a Magnificent Six. Depending on how you cut it. But we're, you know, basically overweight half the names and underweight half the names. And you know, I think that's important. You have to take, they've been, you know, sold as some sort of a package, right? And I realize that certainly worked beautifully as an investment strategy last year. But we've got to remember they're each individual companies with their own dynamics. So, I think the extreme narratives on the Mag 6 or 7 are wrong. You know, the one that sort of waves them off and says, oh, it's some kind of unsustainable mania or bubble. I don't think that's right. When you look at these companies, you know, their growth rates and their near-term expected growth rates in most instances basically kind of support current valuations. On the other hand, the idea that all you need to do is own this particular handful of stocks and you don't really need anything else in your equity portfolio, I think that's too risky a strategy at this point. So again, take them each as they come, individual analysis on whether you should own them or not. And also acknowledge that so far this year, the market has broadened out. A lot of these Mag 7 names have continued to do beautifully, a couple of them haven't, but we're seeing broader participation. You know, things like energy and financials and industrials are doing relatively well this year. So when we look at kind of where we want to be, it's not just a decision about where to be within technology. So we typically are carrying overweight positions within tech and software and services. But also we have increased our exposure in healthcare, a part of the market that performed terribly last year, especially in the kind of the services and devices and area look particularly attractive. We're somewhat overweight in the energy and financials. Again, areas that didn't do terribly well last year, but that we think have that right mix of growth and positive valuations. Of course, if you're overweight stuff, it means you've got to be underweight some other stuff. And, I think that the consumer staples are an area where we've been light. And in general, those categories that have come to be called bond substitutes, defensive names that probably outperform in a down market, but don't have terribly attractive growth rates and perhaps, generate income. I guess, big picture, our view there from an asset allocation perspective would be if actual bonds, high quality bonds are available with yields of, 4 point something or 5 point something, maybe just own the bonds. You don't necessarily need bond substitutes in your equity portfolio.
Are you talking about things like utilities?
Yeah, utilities, REITs, again, a big chunk of the consumer staples sector, the so-called, defensive areas of the market.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm glad you addressed that. We had a question from Larry about which groups you would avoid. So I think you've addressed that well. What about small and mid-cap stocks? We talked about large caps, but how do you feel about the opportunity set for small and mid-caps?
I think the opportunity for set there for long-term investors are very attractive. I mean, you're looking at a, sort of a PE discount on small and mid-caps of 6 to 7 multiple points now, which is historically very attractive. Yeah, in our asset allocation work, we have a recommended allocation to small and mid caps. I'll tell you, we're having an active debate about whether that ought to be increased. I think the valuation metrics certainly support it. I think that the challenge is the macro environment. If we're right that we do get some slowing in the economy, that could further delay the opportunity for mid and small cap to outperform. But again, if you have a 2 or 3 year investment horizon, I would absolutely want to have some small and mid cap exposure because it really is attractively valued compared to its own history, even more so compared to the large cap U.S. market.
So one of the fun things about preparing for this interview, Dave, is that you gave me some questions that you would like to answer. Makes my job easier. So I've got two of them I've saved for the end. Then we'll go to some listener questions. One is, how are you talking to clients about the upcoming presidential election?
Yes, I would say talking about it all too often, given that it's more than 7 months away, but it's sure. A reality. The first thing we try to bring to the fore is just kind of the history of how the stock market does during presidential election years. And the history is it does pretty well. It's up about 85% of the time in presidential election years, looking over the last century. So there's nothing about the fact that it's an election year that should scare equity market investors. And so we go through that. And then a very logical follow-up question would be, yeah, but this year is kind of different, isn't it? And you have to acknowledge certainly that is true. There are a number of unusual circumstances. I think, though, that what we've learned from history is positioning portfolios around who you think is going to win or lose an election.
Bad idea.
Almost always a loser's game. And so we're just trying to emphasize the economic fundamentals. And yes, you think about policy changes that might occur down the road and how might that impact the market. But then again, you just get into a series of ifs, if this person wins, if that party controls the Congress, if, and at some point, you've just got to get back to what's the outlook for the economy, what's the outlook for rates, where are earnings headed, and where are valuations, and frankly, de-emphasize the politics.
I couldn't agree with you more. So I saved my favorite question for last, just because the S&P 500 has worked brilliantly for investors. As you note, it's up 16% annualized for the last 5 years. Will it be that easy going forward?
No, I don't think so. And when you look at the history of investment returns, there is regression to the mean phenomenon that occurs. And so if we're looking at those kind of strong 15, 16% annualized total return numbers that you mentioned, if I were an investor trying to have sort of a sober, realistic expectation about what that might look like in the 5 years forward, I think we'll see below average returns in the S&P 500. You know, maybe it looks more like mid to high single digits, again, kind of regression to the mean. And so for a lot of investors, that may mean needing to look elsewhere to kind of generate the kind of return objectives that you have. We talked earlier about small and mid-cap stocks. I would certainly put a premium on the expected return for small and mid-caps. I think, you know, international this is kind of a waiting for Godot, but at some point international will outperform the U.S. And, you know, investors forget, but if you go back to, say, the decade of the 2000s, international and especially emerging markets dramatically outperformed the U.S. market. So that does happen. It will happen again. And again, that's an area that looks cheap relative to the S&P 500. So investors, I think, may need to be a little bit more active in the asset allocation area to kind of keep up the expected return profile.
And certainly more active than they have been.
Right.
So, all right, speaking of developed markets, CIBC stands for Canadian International Bank of Commerce. And we had a question from Robert. What is your view of the Canadian market and the Canadian dollar?
Yeah, the you know, Canadian equity market actually looks quite different from the U.S. market in terms of what it's comprised of. A much heavier weight in energy, traditional energy and financials than the U.S. market, a lower weight in technology. And so it really is investing in a different set of companies. You could actually say the same about the same about Europe. So you know, I think for investors that are somewhat more income driven in their portfolio goals, I think the Canadian market looks interesting. I think on a secular, you know, 3 to 5 year kind of basis, I would still look for stronger overall earnings growth coming out of the U.S. market. But Canada, again, interesting for more income oriented investors. The U.S. Canadian dollar, I think the potential there would lean more toward strengthening of the Canadian dollar versus the U.S., though, honestly, not dramatically so over the next couple of years.
So we had a dollar question. John asks, does the U.S. need to reduce its national debt to increase global confidence in the dollar as the international trade currency?
Yeah, I mean, I think the
question.
it is a good question, and it's a hard one to answer. On the deficit, it was a question on the trade deficit or the budget deficit?
It was on the budget deficit.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, that's I think everybody has the same view there, which is that it's unsustainable. You just don't know when markets will decide it's unsustainable, and it won't be perceived as a crisis, or we won't have a political resolution to it until it becomes a crisis, and it'll be the markets that determine when that is. I do think, though, that the inflection point in interest costs on the debt, where in the statistic you've seen a lot lately, that the interest on the debt this year is going to be bigger than the entire size of the defense budget, it is on a very dangerous path, and it is going to have to be addressed. But again, we have such a long history here of knowing that won't happen until you get a kind of a financial markets revolt, probably from the bond market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's one of these issues that isn't an issue until all of a sudden it is, and then once it is, it's a really big issue.
Right.
I've never paid as much attention to Treasury auctions as I have over the past year. I think certainly that could be the trigger for a rethinking of the national debt and the U.S.'s fiscal trajectory, broken Treasury auction. But we haven't seen that yet, and there have been some prominent voices who've been calling for that for 20 years. It's not an
only
issue
20?
Until all of a sudden it is one.
Right. That's the problem, as you say. The pessimists could call for it, or the realists could call for it for a long time, and then it suddenly happens. So we had a question about Chinese stocks. Gordon wants to understand your current views on Chinese stocks and their potential in 24.
Yeah, in our international equity portfolio, we do have some China exposure, but it's quite small. It's just a couple of names. I think the challenge with the Chinese market, it's the classic sort of clash of the the micro looking attractive and the macro looking concerning, right? You can find after the dramatic underperformance of the Chinese market over the last couple of years, you can find lots of stocks that look relatively inexpensive. But there is, I think, a legitimate concern out there about what's often called the investability of China. In other words, are the policy proclivities of the Chinese Communist Party and President Xi such that there's not really a landscape that you can count on as an investor? And that's a big part of why China has underperformed and why you're seeing investment flows into China down dramatically. So we would recommend relative caution on China here.
All right. And you're certainly not alone there. We had a question from Alan relating to what you would do if you were Fed chairman. Always a fun game to play, isn't it? And he's wondering, in view of your corporate earnings forecast for the next quarter, really for the next year, and let's add in the recently strong inflation and jobs data, would you be inclined to raise the Fed funds rate? Or I might reframe it and say, do you think there's any chance the Fed will raise rates instead of cutting them?
I would not. I would not raise rates here. I actually think where the Fed has told us they're headed makes a good deal of sense, which is for some period of time here to do nothing and simply assess the data as it comes in. Remember, the last rate hike was July, so they've been in this mode now for almost three full quarters. It's been the right thing to do, and I think waiting a couple more months to see some more inflation data makes sense. As I mentioned earlier, January and February were slightly disappointing. If we get another month or two of disappointment, you can cancel the idea of a June rate cut. But I think they're on the right course. I think the messaging has mostly been good. I mean, we know what they're looking at. So I think that's perfectly appropriate. I think the potential for a hike in rates, it happens only if the inflation numbers over the next couple of months deteriorate and you start to look at 3 and 6 month annualized growth rates that indicate inflation is resurgent instead of coming down. I don't expect that, but that's why they call it a surprise.
For sure. All right. Last question we have time for today comes from Ricardo, who wants to know, is it possible that the 10-year Treasury note will reach 5% again this year? I guess anything's possible, but what might lead to that?
Well, I see earlier comment about disappointingly high inflation readings. That would probably be the source of it. Again, it's not our base case. Right about now, we would actually expect say by year end to see the 10-year somewhat lower than it is now. But clearly the volatility in the bond market's been lower even than the stock market. And if the inflation numbers do deteriorate, you could see a significant spike, at least temporarily, in bond yields. But again, that's less than 50-50 that happens in our view.
Treasury today is at 4.3. Go ahead, Nick.
I think another way that you see long rates go higher is some sort of we're so focused on what the Fed is going to do this month or next month or what the short term for rates is, but there's also a huge range of uncertainty around the longer term rate outlook, and a big part of that is the R star, or the concept of a neutral rate, and the case can be made that it's higher than where it was between the financial crisis and COVID because of long-term fundamental growth is better. Maybe it's too early to say what benefit we'll get from AI, but there is a prospect of productivity gains, meaning that our star is something more like 3% or 3.5% rather than the 2% that we had before. That means that the Fed might not have to cut rates as much as before when it does start to cut, and that could lead to a rethinking of the longer term rate outlook if the economy's productive capacity is a bit higher. So you could see long rates rise as a result of that, but I think that's a slow and gradual process if that does take place. I'm wondering what Dave's thoughts on the longer term rate outlook are also.
Yeah, I think a longer-term rate outlook, I think it's a competition between hopefully improving productivity, but also a rolling off of some of the disinflationary forces that led to that, you know, kind of two-decade period we had of 2% or lower inflation. I think demographics aren't as favorable. Globalization trends are, I would argue, going in reverse, and that was a huge source of disinflation for over 20 years. So I actually think that, again, with sort of a five-year view, the trend inflation rate is going to be somewhat higher than it's been in the prior couple of decades. And so on balance, I would expect bond yields to be, trend a little bit higher than they are now over the next few years. Again, not dramatic, not 1970 style, but higher than we've been used to for most of the last couple of decades.
Wish we had time to continue this conversation. Very interesting. A lot of meaty predictions here. Alas, we are out of time today. So Dave and Nick, I want to thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and thanks for your great questions today. Next week, please join us again on Barron's Live. Barron's Deputy Editor Ben Levison will be back, and we will be talking about stocks and markets and the economy and everything in between. Until then, everyone, have a good week, stay well, and thank you for joining us today.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.